Hey, Last Podcast on the Left listeners, we're looking to get some advertisers to help our podcast stay free as it always has been. We just need you to complete a short anonymous survey that's going to take no more than 5 minutes. The answers that you give are going to help to match us up with advertisers that are going to best fit Last Podcast on the Left and you.
All right, and if you do complete the survey, you're going to be immediately entered into an ongoing monthly raffle to win a $100 Amazon gift card, which is a pretty great prize, if you ask me.
We promise not to share or sell your email address. The fucking government doesn't. But we won't send you an email unless you win. Please go to podsurvey.com/last. That's podsurvey.com/last to take our survey and get a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card or, you know... We're going to sell you some e-cigarettes.
Yeah, that'll be great. Henry, what would you do with a $100 gift card from Amazon?
I think I would buy the new expanded edition of Book of the Law by Aleister Crowley.
Do something better than that when you win with your $100 Amazon gift card.
Thank y'all and hail Satan.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the Last
Podcast on the Left.
Right from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
How was your night?
Good, dude, good. Yeah, just did a couple of shows, and then I watched The Returns, and everyone was very sad.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, is that the zombie one?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
What's The Return?
Election.
There was an election yesterday.
Yeah, so we lost, huh?
No one won. No one lost. It doesn't matter.
This country's been bought. And fucking sold.
Bought and sold.
A long time ago. I don't care what anybody says. We are all a part of an end game that has been played out that started with George Washington's fucking wet dream 29,000 years
ago. He never
ago.
Came.
I'm just saying.
George Washington never ejaculated.
Elections aren't real. If you vote, you're just, it's good exercise.
I voted for the sticker. I voted and I got a sticker that said I voted, and then it was a conversation starter with ladies at the bar.
I did not vote.
Yeah.
Well, then you don't get a sticker. And then you don't know what to talk about with the ladies at the bar.
But the problem with the sticker is then they go like, so you voted? You're mostly getting just like mailmen and like guys that used to be senators.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember when I used to count on a vote, and they always disappointed me.
Yeah, and then they go and they sniff your snicker, they sniff on your sticker, and they remember the good times, past.
I want to smell that sticker glue.
Smells like 1976.
This country is doomed and doesn't matter. There are several layers of secret governments that are working on black op operations that are controlling democracies all over the entire globe.
Well, it is interesting. They actually talk about, and a lot of the announcers are just like, most of the corporate money that came in or the individual PAC money that came into these states are from out of the states, and everybody on the panels are just like, we don't know where the money's coming from, and that's the secret government.
Yes.
Which is very true, but we'll get into that in a later episode. We'll be covering secret governments, which is very, very fun.
Absolutely. We're definitely doing that episode because it's real and it's actually happening. Never mind the team of iguanas that are fucking making sure that our traffic is keeping us slow on the way to work every goddamn
day. Okay, let's get into the episode.
Let's get into it. I'm just saying, I wish that it was lizards. That's the sad thing. It's big, fat, white dudes.
It doesn't matter.
Dangerous.
Reality isn't real. We're just a fucking hologram.
All right. Well, Henry's depressed. Everybody, welcome to the show. That's Marcus Sparks. God, I'm so happy. It's such a great day. It's such a wonderful day for Last Podcast on the Left. Finally, the wayward son has returned to New York City.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming back, Henry.
The seat is somehow warm. The warmth never left it from my bottom.
Yeah. It takes 4 months for a seat to cool after you sit on it, so you just got here in time.
I feel very bad for the family that I'm subletting from because my balls have been on over every surface of that place. Because forget that it's not my house, and so I walk out naked. I have these big bay windows. In Los Angeles.
Right.
I have these big bay windows that face out to like the front yard and this old man who lives next door. And so, but the thing is that I walk around naked 24/7, and sometimes I'll just sit on the kitchen counter eating cereal. I'm literally like, I'll put cereal in my lap naked, and I'll sit on the kitchen counter, and I'll look up, and I see an old man just staring at me. He's fiddling with his pocket like he's looking for change.
But he's got no money. You know that for a fact.
But no, yeah, I've been naked all over that house. I don't know what they're going to find. If there's a black light over there that detects poo smears.
It's gonna be all right. Let's move on to part two. Charles Manson, another crack research job, Mr. Parks. Let's get into it.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, like, we're gonna kind of talk about. Well, you're gonna notice a lot of this again when we talked about from the first podcast. It's Manson is no Jeffrey Dahmer.
No, he is not.
You know, he's no John Wayne Gacy. Mm-mm. Manson is a career criminal that found himself in a series of circumstances outside of his control. We are not taking the Bugliosi stream of thought here that Charles Manson is a super evil mind manipulator.
Right.
We are saying maybe, just maybe, he loved the taste of bush hair.
Yes, he did.
And he loved the concept of living in the desert, but he couldn't handle it.
No.
But he also just kind of drugs and stuff. Things get dark when people have been taking drugs together for a long period of time.
Just look at that Burning Man festival. Day three. Very sad. We're on day two right now.
Well, I want to start with a quote from Charles Manson when he was talking about the kids that he was hanging out with. Because you got to remember, Charles Manson at this time, he was 33 years old.
Right.
And they're all like 16. He's been fucking nothing but 16-year-olds for about 7 months now. So it's changing his mind.
Yeah, the oldest, 23, 24. Like, these are all kids. Mm-hmm. And he said, the deeper I became involved with these kids, the more I hated the world they came from, the more I hated the world that had driven them from their homes, the more I had come from, the more I began to like myself. I started believing I had some of the right answers in my head. But believe me, none of the answers that filled my head included murder.
Believe him that. That's how obnoxious and stupid 16-year-olds are. It made Charles Manson feel superior and smart for the first time in his life. And he was just like, these kids are driving me nuts.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I do the same monologue when I go through Tumblr comments.
All right, so we're going to start this episode with something happy. We're going to start with a birth. We're going to start with a birth.
Is it happy?
Was the birth in a bus by any chance? Because then it's not a happy birth.
The birth was in a condemned house in Topanga Canyon. It was Charlie Manson's second child, a little boy named Valentine Michael, nicknamed Pooh Bear.
That's actually the exact name of somebody that was just born in Park Slope. So that's not so bad. Park Slope, Brooklyn.
That's Gwyneth Paltrow's seventh child.
Yes.
And it said that Charlie bit the umbilical cord himself.
I'm sure that he did, because he's a weird doctor.
No, but again, he's just like, because it sounds like a maniac thing, but it's him just going like, with a knife. Scissor. Oh, we lost all the scissors. Oh, and the scissor party. We had that scissor tossing party.
That's right.
All right, now where's it? I'm just going to have to use God scissors. My own teeth, Mary. I need you to just bear with me for a second. I'm going to be a father, Mary.
That's not so bad, though. A lot of people eat the umbilical cord. It's good. It's got some good vitamins in there.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly dookie.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of juices and various things around there.
It's
that you
a
don't
shit
want
tube.
In your mouth.
It is a shit tube, yeah. It's definitely a shit tube.
So it's around this time that the Manson family... they finally find their home in Spawn Ranch.
Ooh, man.
And here's a little song that Charlie sang about there.
I can feel my bush hair getting longer.
This is Charlie Manson's music, by the way.
Your home is where you can be what you are. They'll never show you that peace of mind, cause they don't know how to be free.
Oh, play his other song, Satellite. This sounds just like Dave Matthews Band.
It does. I was going to say, the lyrics are reminiscent to a Gavin Rosdale's Bush.
It really is.
And that they make no fucking sense. I'm going to go on record here, and I'm going to say that there are a lot of Charlie Manson songs that I like.
Marcus has been listening to the album for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, Lie, The Love and Terror Cult, I've listened to it no less than 7 times over the last, week or so. Mm-hmm.
He's got a good voice.
He's got a real good voice. Mm. Some of his songs are, pretty catchy. It's not a whole lot different than what you're going to find in California in 1968.
No, I mean, if you're tripping nuts on acid, you've got this little wiry, weird dude singing that song around a campfire, talking about death and murder every time he stops playing guitar. I mean, that's a hell of a night.
Yeah, I'm going to start thinking about that all the time and just being like, you know what, Charlie? he throws a pretty catchy tune.
Pretty great. Pretty great. He's like the only musician that you want to hear speak as opposed to actually play the music.
I know. I think about all the years I spent doing mushrooms heavily and the dog shit music I was into. And I was playing tambourines around just being like, they're going to be like, we're going to change the world tonight. You know, just imagine that over 9 months.
Yeah.
And then eventually start killing pregnant women.
Sure.
You can even argue that the Manson family were in reality just super fans.
Yes. Right.
They loved Manson. Not only were they super fans, but they were also a part of his musical journey, which we'll get into here in just a little bit. But before we get to that, we have to talk about Spahn Ranch a little bit. Now, Spahn Ranch was the main base of operations for the Manson family. Sandra Good, a.k.a. Sandy Blue, knew a mechanic at Spahn Ranch, and the mechanic put them in contact with 80-year-old George Spahn. Now, Spahn Ranch, it was mostly used as a movie set for old westerns. They used it in episodes of Bonanza, The Lone Ranger, Zorro, in exchange for simple labor such as taking care of the horses, cleaning George's house, cooking, and having Squeaky fuck him every once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way he presented like them even getting the Spahn Ranch is that Manson showed up with two of his front street girls, right? And he made sure, you know, like, leave the bras at home, girls.
Yeah.
And they walked over there, and they basically showed up. George Spahn, supposed to be blind, and like Charles Manson's like, I heard the man was blind, but he was reaching out and shaking hands like he had fine old fashioned eyeballs. But I knew
something.
For a fact that but then later on when I watched him tripped over a rock, I knew then that he was in fact blind.
He was blind.
But he was like talking about how George Spahn would come up and like grip their shoulders and stuff and like play with the women's arms. And he's like, I can tell you that he's going for a little squeezy sport right there. So I sent him to my fine young redhead and she gave him a tug a rub. And guess next thing I know, we got a sweet spot in our own spot of heaven called Spahn Ranch.
For a tug a rub. That's not bad. This guy was 80 years old. And he was still getting hard, huh?
Yeah, still getting hard.
Before
still fucking
Viagra,
squeaky.
Before the GMOs have been putting our goddamn food, ruining our goddamn boat.
And Manson said that he never made Squeaky fuck George. He said that the reason why Squeaky fucked George was so she could have the comforts of living in the main ranch house instead of in the, I guess they were called the outlaw cabins.
Honestly, and if you think about the main group is literally sleeping on top of each other, a bunch of rugs, they're covered in chiggers. They talk about when one person got the clap, they don't know who all gave each other the clap, and then they all have the clap.
Yep.
I think Squeaky made the right choice.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to suck an 80-year-old man's dick so you can get a bedroom.
Right. An 80-year-old farmer, though, he's probably in good shape, harvesting the land his whole life.
I don't know. He's a movie farmer.
Yeah,
that's true. He's not a real farmer. This is a movie set.
It's Spahn Ranch. I mean, Spahn Ranch does sound like the kind of place you have to, like, gurgled cum just to enter.
Well, they got horses. And
no one had sex with the horses, right?
By the way, if you guys want to see the most adorable thing that you've ever seen in your life, look for a picture of Charles Manson on a horse. He's so adorable.
He's tiny.
He's the tiniest man.
He's 5'4". He was a tiny, tiny little man.
He looks like a child at a birthday party.
He must have been so scared on top of that horse. Just trying to keep it together. If I fall off this horse, they're never going to trust me as their Lord and Savior.
Yeah, come on, horse. This horse is... It's covered in butter. It's always covered in butter. You know who did it, man? It was the man coming down on me, covering all my horses in slick olive oil, so I fall right off of them.
Oh, my goodness.
So us here, through our research, what we found...
But I do think that he probably told someone to butter the horse the night before. Hey, I'm going there. Butter the horse.
Why, Charlie? Why? Don't ask me why.
The next morning at breakfast, what happened to all the butter? I don't know. I'm going on the horse.
Well, I'm going to ride that horse over there, and it better be good and grippy because I'm going to be riding it all over the canyon.
That's where the butter was.
I got to write down my commands that I give after 1 o'clock in the morning.
I got to write them down. I'm going to give them to Squeaky. I'm going to say, Squeaky, you hold on to this until 6 a.m.
And
then
it's 6 a.m. You let me know everything I agreed to the night before.
And then at 6 a.m., we're going to decide whether it's a good idea or not.
Honestly, Manson, in his own words, has given me a great deal. I am now on Marcus's team. I have a great deal of sympathy for Charles Manson.
Yeah.
I just think the man was a stupid criminal. The man is basically Damon Wayans' character from Mo Money. You know what I mean? It's like he's that like character of just like he's just like Mo Money. It's just all about like he thinks he's this slick criminal, but actually he's an idiot. And next thing you know, he has this gaggle of drug crazed freaks all around him.
Well, with Manson, yeah. we can take it back to Gary Ridgway. Gary Ridgway, as we discussed, was adult. He was an mm-hmm. idiot, you know, as far as, you know, normal society went. But he was really fucking good at one thing. He was really good at killing prostitutes.
And Charles Manson is really good at eating pussy.
Yeah. And it's like, white and umbilical cord.
And I will also probably put on record that Charles Manson's the only serial killer that knew where the clitoris was.
Yeah.
But Charles Manson, maybe. What he was good at was manipulating people.
Yes.
Because, as we said in the last episode, he spent from the years of 12 to 19 in prison, and then he spent from 21 to 26 in prison as well. So Charles Manson, little guy, the only way this guy is going to survive in these horrific environments is if he learns how to talk
crazier and faster and than everybody else. He's got to play a big game.
Yeah.
And so now we're going to watch. Yeah. We're going to watch a game escalate.
Yeah. Yeah. It gets even bigger when he meets Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys.
No, I love the two different sides of this story.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two. Dennis Wilson, he was the drummer of the Beach Boys. He was Brian Wilson's brother, of course. Brian Wilson, the genius behind Pet Sounds, Smile, all that type of stuff. Wilson was
He was the least talented member of the Wilson family.
By far the least talented member of the. I mean, he was the fuck up. He was the party guy. He was the guy that liked to fuck all the time.
Yeah. And Brian Wilson's insane, right?
He's
crazy. Yeah. And Brian Wilson's absolutely insane.
I'm sure the Beach Boys management were like, we already got one Wilson that's hard to deal with, but he's a fucking genius. We can't deal with this other one. So they would just basically let Dennis Wilson disappear for months while they were making Pet Sounds.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So Dennis Wilson, of course, liked to fuck a lot. He's driving down the highway one day, and he sees a couple of mildly attractive women walking down the road.
So Manson attractive.
Yeah. Manson attractive women.
Mansom.
Yep. And one of the women. Mansom.
Manson.
Yeah. Then one of the women has, she drifted away from the family soon afterwards, but one of the others was Big Patty Patricia Krenwinkel.
Ooh, yeah. Oh, and this is perfect for Dennis Wilson. Yeah, they don't let me record no music anymore, but Big Patty, you understand what I'm talking about, right?
They call him a quarter pounder at the ranch. So there are two different versions of the story.
Yeah.
One is that Dennis Wilson met these two girls. They bring them back to his house. They started fucking. They're like, you gotta meet God. You gotta meet Jesus. You gotta meet our friend Charlie. And he's just like, yeah, bring Charlie over. And then, yeah, whatever you gotta do. Suck my dick. And so they bring Charles Manson and the whole gaggle over to Dennis Wilson's
while Dennis Wilson is recording.
Yes.
Like, he leaves the house and he comes back at 3 a.m.
And so he comes, but this is Dennis Wilson's side of the story. Manson and his whole coterie show up at the mansion and take over the whole fucking thing. And basically use his money, hang out, they all fuck and they do drugs and they do all this stuff. But basically they are a massive leech. But then if you listen to Manson in his own words, Manson's like, this cool cat named Dennis Wilson at a freak out party. We did it. They always say the term, we did a joint.
Yeah.
Like, we did a joint at each other. And then next, you know, we were rapping about music and we were on the same trip, man. Me and him, just like, we knew. It was just like, yeah, he was a beach boy, but me, man, I'm coming up, I'm a wizard from the desert. He's just like, yo, Charlie, you a real wizard of the desert. And I was like, you all with Dennis Wilson? You've always been right. You've always been my friend. And then he's like, Dennis Wilson invited me to his home and I went over there and yes, we spent all his money. And yes, we ate all his food. And yes, we gave the dogs of the house body chiggers from Sadie. All right,
sure.
But he never asked us to leave until he asked us to leave.
Then you gotta go for sure. When Dennis asks you to go, you gotta go.
Yeah, but Dennis was still, he was a little bit enamored with him. Him and Charlie actually became fairly good friends.
Well, it's because, I mean, again, you're just getting your blow and drugs. There's so much drugs. There's so much sex happening. You get it kind of like rolled into it. And then all of a sudden you realize I've got 20 homeless people living in my mansion.
Right.
Well, the Manson family, if you've ever been involved in music in any way, like been a part of a scene, if you've ever been really been into any particular kind of music where there's always people coming in and out, there's always this one weird group of people, usually crust punks, that sidle into the scene. They come in and out. They've always got girls. They've always got drugs. And there's always one weird charismatic guy at the front of it all, and usually they just kind of come in, you fuck a couple of the girls, they go out, they give you some acid, it's fine. And that one weird guy, a little unpredictable, you just kind of put up with him. That's what Charles Manson was to everyone in the music scene. He was just this weird little guy with all of the chicks and all of the drugs just showing up and having a good time. Every once in a while, he'll pull out a knife.
Sure.
And he'll wave it around.
He'll wave it around.
But that's a part of what it is. That's a part of what his mystique is.
Yeah. Right. That he's and everyone knows that he's a criminal, and everyone knows that he's been in prison most of his life.
But he's sort of comical.
Yeah, but he's sort of, he's like.
Yeah, because he's 5'4".
Right, exactly.
Everyone's looking at this guy. He's like, what's this guy going to do? Because he's going like, I wrote a spider here today. And he's like, what are you? You fucking, probably like, you're a Lilliput?
Yeah.
And then he, I do love, I think it's a really accurate quote that Wilson even said, like, just kind of the phrasing of it. When they were talking about when he met the two girls, and they were describing him, and he's like, he drifted into crime, but when I met him, I found he had great musical ideas. We're writing together now. He's dumb in some ways, but I accept his approach and have learned from him. Because it's true. Right. Again, it's just like everyone literally was just like looking at him like, this guy's a fucking moron.
You're an
idiot.
But
he's kind of got something to him.
Most criminals are extremely stupid. You know, that's the whole thing about it. But I mean, if you're Dennis Wilson, you don't know what normal is. Brian Wilson's your brother. Right? I mean,
that's totally true.
He has never been around anybody normal in his entire life.
And their father is a horrible fucking human being. Eventually their father sold every Beach Boy song for about $700,000.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, fuck, man. Insane. You think that is insane. That's nothing.
I love that they're called the Beach Boys too, because it just sounds like they're about to solve a mystery about who stole the ice cream.
That was the best part. And then they were all just schizophrenics, losers, psychopaths, and egomaniacs. Yeah. All right, so but through him, he meets Terry Melcher.
He was the son of Doris Day. He was a huge producer. He was behind some of the Byrds' greatest hits, like Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, Turn, Turn. This guy was big in the 60s music business.
Turn, Turn, Turn is an obnoxiously stupid name for a
Things
song.
Things used to be simpler.
Right.
Yes, they
now,
did.
Now, we're
going
to call this one Mr. Tambourine Man, because he's got tambourine, he's a guy. And then the other one, like, what do you want to do when you turn? When you start turning, you want to turn, turn, turn. Here we go.
It makes sense. It makes sense. Now, can we please record it? I'm getting blown right now. I'm about to shoot.
Let's go.
So Melcher, he did show an interest in Manson. It's not.
He showed an interest in Manson's acid.
No, he did not. No, he did not.
He liked his music?
No, you can say whatever you want about Charlie Manson's music, but there was very real interest in Charlie Manson as a recording artist.
Because he also, again, you see this tiny weird man with this group of guys. It's a whole approach. He actually was a very, very smart in the idea of PR, of a publicity.
Yeah, women and drugs.
It's all manipulation. This is just a further part of his manipulation.
Yeah.
He just wasn't good at it. Once he could get in the door, but once he got in the door,
he didn't have the chops.
Yeah, he didn't have the chops at all. So Melcher brought him up. This is I would love to see the demo that Charles Manson, the process of Charles Manson recording a demo at Brian Wilson's house. That is a day that would go down in history.
It's like that thing where you like everyone's like, I took the wrong way. I chose the wrong day to quit sniffing glue.
Well, the
so
demos.
So Brian Wilson and Charles Manson, did they ever meet?
No, this is when Brian Wilson was in his. I think this
he was
is
in
like,
bed.
Yeah, he was like laying in his bed.
He was just in bed.
He was in bed for like 3 months.
Because I think that would have ended the world, right? Like that's when the world implodes.
Only if they became best friends,
right?
Like if they or would have saved a bunch of people, and then all of a sudden Charles Manson and him are just laying in bed together doing that weird John Lennon Yoko thing.
God, I would love to hear Charles Manson on Smile. Charles Manson and Van Dyke Park
getting
together.
Smile.
Oh, yeah,
you got to. Smile, 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 girl, yeah.
He's like a hip-hop hype man. He would be great.
So in the recordings, they've never been officially released, but in a movie that both me and Henry watch, where we got a lot of this information from, it's called Cease to Exist, you can hear the producer talking to Charlie, and you can hear Charlie refusing to be produced. If you know anything about music, in recording music.
Because you were talking about it, too, because it was like, the girls wanted to look at Charlie when they were singing their songs, and he's just like, no, girls, it doesn't work like that. I put the microphones where they are for a fucking reason.
Right,
and they kept moving the microphones around and dancing around. Jules
and he's like, man, I don't like this microphone in front of my face. It looks phallic. Yeah, this phallic thing in front of my face. But I put my mouth on it if you want me to, but I probably ain't gonna.
Charlie, we're... We're desperately trying to record an album here.
Right. Charlie, this is not about you being raped in prison multiple times when you were a child.
I was raped.
We know, Charlie. Get over it. Get out of the fetal position, please, Charlie. Can you put the microphone down here?
Well, the thing about Manson's music is that Manson's music was so deeply and amazingly personal. Like, his music was the core of him. It
you really like
absolutely
it.
Everything.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like you like it too much, Marcus.
No, I'm not saying. I'm saying that's how Manson felt.
When you
it.
Read Manson's right. own words, you realize that this whole thing happened because of music. His yeah. music was
the
so important
thing.
To him,
it
which
did,
is
to some degree,
which to me bespeaks the whole tragedy of it. Is the fact that like it meant so much to him, and he was still pretty mediocre at it.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
it's like he poured his heart and soul into this thing that was a thing that would never. Be successful.
Well, he's like everybody, especially nowadays. He likes the idea of being a musician, but he doesn't understand the hard work that goes into it. He had everything that a musician has. Drugs, women.
He liked
friends.
The lifestyle. He yeah. liked the appearance of it. And then when it comes down to the actual... I actually don't even know if it's skill. It's just know-how. He didn't know how to record. He didn't know how to do it.
He didn't right. know how to record. And I think
it's boring. Recording in a studio is boring.
It is the worst.
It's like
I'm in the middle of recording an album right now, and it's
right.
fucking... It is the most boring, repetitive, tedious thing that you can yeah. do as a musician. But you have to do it, and you have to be... produced. You have to
yes.
listen to what your producer is telling
and
you.
He can,
but he took
Manson. Charles
every,
Manson.
Yeah, it's Charles Manson. right. Every single suggestion, anything, he would take it extremely personal. It's not that he couldn't follow advice. It's not that he couldn't follow directions. It's that he absolutely wouldn't. He said about the sessions, he said, they didn't want us to perform as I felt we should.
Yeah, and then Terry right. Melcher then said that the group and the members of the family made promises that they couldn't keep.
Yeah.
Which was like...
That they were talented?
Yes,
that they
exactly.
could play music?
Yeah. All right, so now, through Dennis Wilson, we meet the guy that is probably the crux
yeah.
of most of the horrible events we know
yeah.
about Charles right.
Terry Melcher. And as far as pissing off Manson and making him bitter, even more bitter, the Beach Boys stole one of his songs.
Which one was it?
Cease to Exist, which became a song called Never Learn Not to Love.
They completely changed the lyrics. They kind of
yeah.
they kept the melody.
They kept the melody, and they kept some of the lyrics. But
yeah.
they changed certain things here and there. But
never learn not to love.
Never learn not to love.
I don't know what that means.
It's a Beach Boys song. It's a mediocre Beach Boys song. The
okay.
Beach Boys had a lot of mediocre songs. They had
right.
like one good album.
Re-listen to that title after you smoke a fucking Hog's Life.
Oh,
then
you'll
know
get
like,
yeah,
then,
yeah.
then you'll back.
Okay.
Then you'll yeah,
never
yeah.
learn not to
yeah.
love.
You'll never learn not to love. You'll
huh.
get it eventually.
I like Cease to Desist is better.
Exist,
yeah. Cease to exist. Cease and desist. Cease to
yeah.
exist. That's
but
cool.
Charlie saw this. He saw this rejection of his music. He saw this as a rejection of himself. This is another example
right.
of the world looking at Charlie Manson and saying, we don't want you.
He also has that prison mentality where it's been nothing but him on him this whole time. So
yeah.
he has worked up this one-sided conversation in his head about
mm-hmm.
how his music was undeniable for years and years and years. And so when he shows up. And
he's also got a bunch of women and a bunch of people telling
that are reverberating
that
it back.
Right. Your music will change the world. This is the best thing ever.
His ego's out of control.
Oh God, it's so out of control.
And so having someone come and say no, especially someone who knows what he's doing, who's a real record producer, who can then use that power on top of him.
Mm-hmm.
He Charles Manson again has that sort of baby Hitler thing inside of him, that inferiority complex, and this is what starts. The dark road.
Yeah, this is definitely where
yep.
it begins. And it
Too
also,
bad.
And the person who really takes him down the dark road also shows up this time, a man named Charles Tex Watson.
Now, Tex
yeah.
Watson made Charles Watson, Tex Watson made Charles Manson look like fucking Robert Oppenheimer. Made him look like a genius.
Oppenheimer.
Yeah, you know, like,
Tex
like,
Watson. Yeah.
Tex Watson is a fucking, it's bad luck
he
got involved.
I think
yeah.
he self-nicknamed himself Tex, too.
No,
which,
George Spahn named him Tex.
Nah, I give it to him. whatever. But he's he has no talent whatsoever, this Tex Watson.
Tex Watson's just some dude from a small town in Texas.
Right.
He was from Copeville, Texas. Everyone, and he was the person that Charles Bugliosi, the DA that prosecuted Manson, he was the guy that Bugliosi put up as, look at what Charles Manson did
to these innocent boys.
These innocent small town, like he was a football player for fuck's sake.
Oh, yeah,
there's
they don't
no
do
way,
anything wrong.
There's no way that a football player could ever possibly hurt a woman.
And now we know they're the most dangerous members of society.
Well, some of them are.
Yep, he was a church-going kid. And a lot of these, you see this again and again in the Manson family, a lot of these people had religious upbringings.
Well, of course. You have to have had it in order to even understand groupthink. It's all fucking standardized religions do is teach you groupthink and how to follow along and how to follow rules and believe in a fucking magic set of circumstances that are going to punish you just because you've been jerking off in a boys' room every once in a while. Just to ease
Whoa,
attention.
What happened?
I'm just saying, just to ease the tension.
To ease the, you had a jack off in the boys' room?
Yeah.
Oh my, I don't know what religion that is.
Catholicism.
Ah, that's right. Yeah, well, the priest watches and makes sure you do it right.
Yeah.
So,
you didn't make the cream big enough, child.
Oh. All right, I'll try it again. Okay.
So after he graduated from high school, he visited California, picked up, moved out west, signed up for jobs for classes at Cal State, and got a job as a wig salesman in Beverly Hills.
Wow.
Dropped out of school and moved to Malibu, decided to open up a wig shop of his own with his roommate, a store called Lovelocks. that only lasted a few months.
It's fucking the wig market. It's booming right now.
It's Malibu. Yeah,
the 1967 wig market when people were in need of long hair.
There was a bubble.
There was
and the
a bubble
popped. And that's a shame that Tex Watson was a part of that, one of the casualties to the bubble,
sad,
the wig bubble.
Yeah. In 64, everyone went down to Los Angeles, and Malibu was short hair. And they said, this isn't cool. And overnight, you got to change. You got to go to the wig store.
So to pay rent, Watson starts dealing pot full time and starts getting involved with the criminal element. Charles picked up Dennis Wilson hitchhiking one day because Dennis Wilson just liked to hitchhike.
He was just
as Charlie
crazy
Manson
person.
Said, like I said before, he was a bit of a rebel. So Wilson invited him back to the Manson, to the mansion, and that is where he met Charles Manson. And as Watson says, and Watson and all the people who were, it's really interesting to me when you look at the interviews with the Manson people who got caught immediately just flipped on him and just said, you know what, no, he just did all this stuff to us, he brainwashed us. But everyone who didn't get caught was like, yeah, we're still on this trip, man.
Yeah.
We're fucking on this trip forever. We ain't never getting off of the fucking Manson train. But the people who are facing death row said, oh no, we were good Christian
Absolutely.
Kids.
Absolutely,
of course.
Listening
what
to Patricia Krenwinkel, like when she gave this interview afterwards, she's like, I will never ever forgive Charles Manson for what he did to me. And it's just like, he finger banged you until you could learn how to smile.
Exactly. You were loving your life. Yeah, before it was all frowns and moons, and now it's all sunshine and smiles.
Let's just go ahead and we're going to say it right now. Everyone involved in this scenario is an idiot.
Is an idiot.
Oh,
all
definitely.
These people are idiots. They're all dumb. They're all extremely impressionable. They're all just looking for something. They're all just looking for someone to follow, and they're dumb enough to follow an ex-con named Charlie.
And Tex Watson was basically kind of a loser dude who couldn't ever figure out how to do it. And they were saying here, like, you know, he struggled how to accumulate all I could, the right car, the right clothes, the right things, and would somehow complete what I thought was missing inside me. Now I gave all, everything I had to Charlie. Suddenly, I felt very free.
And then Charlie was just like, what am I going to do with all these wigs? All you got is wigs, Tex. Get out of here.
Listen, Charlie, listen. We take all the wigs. We sew them all up into him.
Yeah.
Wig monster.
No, you can stay. Make the wig monster happen.
Technically, that's an idea, Tex. Yeah. I don't know where we're going to utilize it yet, but I don't know. We also just got a trampoline, so if you could go tighten the springs of that trampoline, that would also be great. Thank you. Thank you, Tex.
Every cult needs a wig monster.
So Tex got brought back to Spawn Ranch.
So it was Dennis Wilson, though, just to clarify. Dennis Wilson's the one who introduced Tex Watson to everybody?
Absolutely. Yeah. Dennis Wilson, he's got a pretty big hand inadvertently. Like he
checked the fuck out as soon as everything went down.
Yeah, as soon as everything went down, he checked out. But he really, without Dennis Wilson's influence, none of this would have happened.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting how it's these tiny little connections that made this. So first it was the van.
The van,
it,
yeah.
It was the Reverend's van. Mm-hmm. And then it was Dennis Wilson's involvement. These little things all sort of like strung. It's because there's a lot of sort of like fate involved in
yes,
all
there
this.
Is.
And
sure.
It, like all this stuff kind of was a fragile thing that led to the murders. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. You yeah. watch it and it's kind of, and we talk about this before about how like watching the fall of the Manson family is like watching the fall of the 60s itself.
Yeah.
And right. it's very interesting. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And it happens fast. But we'll get to that here in a bit. This is funny. Tex Watson, Charlie helped him out with his sexual inadequacies.
How do you do that?
Sometimes he would fondle in baby Tex, and then he'd send him to have sex with a woman that Manson had pre-selected for
him. So Manson would fondle his nuts a little
bit?
Yeah,
she would
tug
him, give him a little tuggity tug. Yeah.
Yeah, a little,
and then
a little
that would,
tug.
That's what got Tex hard.
Give him a back rub and say, like, come on, man, you're good. Just go out there and fucking get
fucking,
that
kid. Yeah, let me. Right. You know how many times, I don't know how many times where it's like, maybe I'm not in the mood. And sometimes right. I think about, you know I really wish I had a scraggly 5'4" bearded yeah. man who was just ripped on whatever. He hasn't been bathed in maybe months.
No, he smells like sex.
I really want him to be tugging on me.
Right.
Because that fucking gets me going like a lawnmower.
So we know Tex grew up in a religious background. He moved to Malibu to open a wig store, and then he got stroked off a bunch by Charles Manson. So he's gay then. Is that right? Or
No. It's the opposite. He's very, very, very straight.
He's very straight.
Yes, yes.
Straight enough to
straight.
Get wigs and straight enough to get hard for a dude.
It's a time of free love, people. These people are outside of your judgments, Ben.
No, I'm not judging. I'm just saying maybe Tex could have just really benefited from a loving relationship.
During this time, Charles Manson was doing during the involvement of Dennis Wilson, they put him in touch with a lot of Hollywood people. And so Charles Manson was always talking about, he's like, you wouldn't believe the kind of raps and kind of trips I was tripping on, man. When I walked out to these parties, it was like all sorts of, I won't even begin to name names, but the biggest celebrities you know all love to do blow, get turned on, and ball each other out in the backyard. And I saw men on men.
Right. You
know? And so he was talking about how he was approached by a very famous Hollywood actor.
Yes.
And he was like, I was on set because he was, apparently they had asked him to advise on a new movie about Jesus Christ.
Allegedly.
That, right. That he was advising the script, and he was like, it's like, and I was talking to all these screenwriters, and I kind of knew, it was like, maybe I could be a screenwriter. And it was like, I'd love to see the movie called, Banana Takes a Walk. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so he goes.
Then the banana gets peeled, you see. Yeah.
Mm. It's good. It's short. but he saw this, this famous actor and him were kind of talking about stuff. And he's like, and the actor comes up to him. He's like, I heard you have connections to get certain things. And he's just like, let me guess. You want it in the mouth of the ass. And they go into his dressing room. Mm. He fucks his actor, right? They come back out, and he's just like, and I hate to do it, but I'll show anybody a little attention. Like, it's like he's always about giving love. I always give love.
Oh, yeah.
And so finally, the actor invites him over to his house, and he's just like, I show up at his old fancy mansion. His old lady's sitting there in a satin robe hanging over it, and I can see her bush hanging out. And I was like, ooh, this is about to get a little Monopoly in here. And he turns over. He turns over, and so he was just like, I thought I was gonna be balling the two of them together, but the next thing you know, he motions me over to his wife. So I start eating her out. I start going, giving her the push and push, stick him. I got all, because he always used to say, I pushed it deep in her. In her.
Yeah, and his sexual exploits can go on for pages upon pages.
Vivid, very graphic. But then literally, so I pulled down my pants and I started fucking, and it's like, it's kind of hot, and then you put Charles Manson in it.
Yeah.
It's like it's kind of hot, and then it's Charles Manson's singer.
Yeah.
And so he's fucking in the good dude's wife, and he's like, so I sit there, and he starts just kind of, he starts giving himself a little tug of rub, and I'm sitting there, and I'm fucking his wife. Next thing I know, he hears pants sliding down his ankles.
Uh-oh.
And I was just like, I've been raped before. And he was like, I will not be raped again. But he settled up, and they're like walking like a dog on his hands and feet, walking around, so sucking on his wife's toes.
Wild.
And then the next thing I know, when I was done, he folded up 5 $100 bills and put them in my front pocket and told me he'd see me every Friday.
And that man was Robert Wagner. Robert Wagner, little known fact about the Wags.
It's just so funny where it's just like, I cannot believe that someone would pay him to have sex with, like
$500, and this is what, the 60s, right?
Yeah, that's like
big time money.
It's like $3,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, but he's a prostitute. He's just a sexually assaulted prostitute in a lot of ways.
I mean, the way he tells it and I mean, really, if you look at it, the kind of hold that he had over the people in the family, he talks about himself as if he is the... No one in 1968 in California fucked better than Charles Manson.
Yes,
it's possible. That's how he tells it. He did seem a little bit freaked out by the toe thing, which is pretty JV considering what Charles has done.
Absolutely. You know? No, he's just like, he always talks about like finger banging girls until they're skyrocketing orgasms.
Yeah. And they're like having sex for days at a time.
And then also,
yeah,
but then
he's like Sting.
He was kindly also playing the thing where all the girls always loved being on top of each other and listen to his every one of his commands. And I'm just like, I don't know. I still feel like there is a level of agreeable brainwashing where you kind of give up yourself to it.
Yeah.
And I don't think necessarily like, there's a lot of rape happening. You know what I mean? There's a lot of rape happening, but they have to all go along with it because you're afraid of this man. You're kind of afraid of Charles Manson. You don't think so?
I don't think there was any rape involved. I think that Charlie Manson was a consensual type of guy.
I'm going to send a letter to Patricia to fucking the Big Patty and then see what she says.
Big Patty.
You know what Big Patty's going to say. You don't even have to send the letter.
All right. So what is the next? So now it's they're adding the final members of the family.
Yeah,
right?
this is when the family finally starts coming together. Next up, they add Leslie Van Houten, who is one of the four people involved in the murders. She was born in California, Altadena. She had a lot of adopted younger siblings. They were all orphans from the Korean War. She was a good student. Her mother said her grades were never good enough for me.
God.
Yeah.
And she, of course, wondered why she ran into the arms of Charles Manson, who was just like, what school?
Yeah. What school all about?
And she played the sousaphone as well.
Oh, wow.
And the drums. Yeah, they said that she looked hilarious to get in that big burp, 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 big tuba walking field.
She had one of those tiger moms.
Yeah.
And then the tiger mom drove her to Charles Manson.
Yeah. Mm. She was a happy kid. Her parents divorced when she was 14. At
she was
16,
good looking, too.
She was good looking. Leslie Van Houten was, you know, arguably the best looking member, although I'm more of a squeaky guy myself.
Squeaky's gorgeous. Squeaky's actually very gorgeous.
Squeaky's a gorgeous
woman. Her jerking off the 80-year-old blind man, that's what kind of hurts me.
I don't mind it.
You forget about it, you know?
I like it. I don't mind. I think it's sweet.
I mean, it is kind of sweet.
I mean,
I don't know.
Why did they have Fat Susan do it, though, if he's blind?
Send Big Patty in there.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I think you're right, Henry. Squeaky just jumped on the right situation. Squeaky, you know, hey, she wasn't involved in the murders.
She got a bathroom.
Yeah, she
did.
I mean, yeah, she did try to kill Gerald Ford about six years later.
But that was a thing. That was a whole different thing.
Yeah,
that
maybe
was a whole
different thing. She thought she was just shooting at Chevy Chase.
That was her Lady Gaga meat dress.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, the funny thing about her is that this was not the first cult that she joined, the Manson family. Her first cult was called the Self-Realization Fellowship. She was dating this...
boring!
Yeah,
well, that is actually... It's a real place, too. It still exists.
It's real, yes.
It's a meditation resort.
It sounds awful.
Yeah, it's... It was enough of a cult where they had nuns and monks. Because she was dating this dude named Bobby, who had introduced her to marijuana and acid. She was dating this dude named Bobby, and he brings her in. And she said, if you want to be a monk, then I'll be a nun. She lasted 8 months.
Yeah.
Wow. And she stopped doing every single illicit activity.
These cults have a lot of high turnover rates.
Huge turnover rates. The Manson family had a gigantic turnover rate.
Scientology found out, and that's why Scientology locks them in for life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Manson family at its largest was about 30 members.
Jesus.
It's bigger than I think most people think. Because you think about the Manson family, you think about like 8-9 people. But at one point, yeah, it was up to 30 people listening to this asshole talk. But she was in the SLF for about 8 months. She went to business school to become a secretary for him, but she got bored, left, went to Haight-Ashbury in the late 60s. And she said by the time she got there in like 1968, she said it was, quote, just all gutter.
Yeah, it must have been really nasty.
It had to have been terrible. By 1968, I mean, the Haight-Ashbury. And
hippie movement lasted for 6 years.
Yeah,
right.
If even that. I mean, you could even bring it a little bit in a little bit closer to maybe 4 or 5. Like, the true hippie movement was very, very short. And this is another thing to keep in mind is that the murders happened August 8th, 1969. Leslie Van Houten joined the Manson family in 1968. All Manson had gotten out of prison in 1967.
All of this that we've talked about has happened in like a year and a half.
Yes. Right. Everything that happened with the Manson family happened within the span of a year and a half
and
to
of
2 years.
Again, keep in mind, this corresponds perfectly with the end of the Whig movement. You know, 1966, Whigs were flying off the shelves.
Once it became fine to be bald, once bald meant sexy, that's been the downfall of this whole fucking country.
That's right.
So the next guy to come in who knew Leslie Van Houten, this guy named Bobby Boussier.
Boussier?
A.K.A. Cupid, a.k.a. Jasper, a.k.a. Cherub.
Hey, I'm Jasper. Y'all want some quiche because I made some quiche? I couldn't find eggs, so it's dirt. It's dirty. I call it quiche, though. Hi, y'all. Hi.
Jasper, Cupid, or Cherub?
Yeah.
So he's just a fat, weird, kissy kind of guy?
Yeah.
He was
he's
licking everybody?
He was a chubby short dude.
It's me. I'm the one. That's what I would have been in the Manson family.
That's cool.
Bobby would be the man holding the knife in the very first Manson murder, before the Tate murders, before the LaBianca murders. He's a guy that was actually really plugged into the 60s counterculture. He was in a band with Arthur Lee called Grassroots. Grassroots would eventually become Love.
You fucking missed that train, didn't you, fucking Bobby?
And he also was friends with Frank Zappa. He was a backup singer on Zappa's first album. And
I didn't know that he was in Lucifer Rising.
I was actually talking to Ragnar about this, because as soon as I found out that he was in Lucifer Rising, I was like, holy shit, Ragnar needs to know about this right now. But he did some further research and found out that he was supposed to play Lucifer.
He
got cut from a Kenneth Anger movie. Yeah, he was supposed to be in Lucifer Rising.
What happened?
But didn't make the cut.
Yeah, so maybe just probably didn't show up.
Yeah, fat and weird.
Used a grip. They used the guy who was supposed to do sound that day, and they're like, we don't need sound. We'll just make it up as we go. You know, it's a Kenneth Anger movie.
Yeah, exactly. So Leslie and Bobby, they were wandering around California. They ran into the Manson family bus. Bobby already knew him. Leslie, she fit right in. She said, it was like I had known them forever. It was like walking into a group of old friends.
Again, acid helps.
Acid helps a lot.
This.
They were real dumb. We were real dumb. And we just fit right in together.
So it's the fall of 1968, and this is when shit starts to go
and
south.
And it happens in like a month.
But fall, it's such great weather.
Yeah.
Especially in Los Angeles. Mm. It's beautiful this time of year.
Yeah. And so you think back to the time of, you know, Dennis Wilson and Terry Melcher. Manson's been trying to get into recording forever. He's been rejected again and again. His bitterness is rising. His anger is rising.
Meanwhile, they're trying to build a new, like a big thing during this time too, is that they're trying to find a new spot because they're getting kicked out of Spahn Ranch over and over again. I wonder why.
Because Squeaky's not doing the goddamn good work
anymore. But literally,
you've
just got like a group that's swelling to like 40 almost, and it's just, now it's turning into bikers, and it's turning into all these like people, and they're just doing drugs, and they're fucking the place up, and everybody's covered in dirt, and the whole, body chiggers everywhere. Yeah. And they found, they're like, okay, so they went out they basically found a completely isolated desert spot.
A couple of ranch houses Death Valley.
Yes.
And somebody knew it through somebody. I mean, everyone knew somebody that got them somewhere in the Manson family.
Because the Manson family was also starting getting torn apart by inner tensions now. Now it's becoming this point where they've kind of just been waiting for Manson to make it in the music business.
Yeah,
so Manson's going to make it, Charlie's going to make it, and we're all going to go with him. And then when Charlie wasn't getting the fucking over the lip,
right,
they were like, okay, where do we go now? What do we do? And they're like, they would have these open dinners where they would like all be able to like speak their mind. And they're all be like, I want to go to England. I want to go back to Mendocino. I want to do this. I want to do this. And like Charlie's like trying to figure out what to do. So he finds a new desert location that is just fucking inhabitable.
It actually was all right. It had running water. It had hot springs.
But
around
the problem is there was nothing there.
There was nothing around it. And they were in Death Valley, for fuck's sake.
And he has no idea how to live in the desert. And so his new project was to get everybody, because Charles Manson was obsessed with living in the desert. He thought that it was the only place he could find peace. And so he was like, we'll all go out to this place, and that was going to be our new project. But everyone's like, we don't want to live in the desert. We want to live in Los Angeles. And he's like, there's a race war happening. And then it turned into this, you're going to see him trying to give this group a new identity while converting VWs into dune buggies for some reason.
Very fun to do. If there was a reality show, if it was nowadays, they would be reality
shows.
So
November 1968, we have an album come out.
Yeah, 1968 is when the White Album comes out, blowing minds all over the world. This is when Helter Skelter comes about.
Now, it's really true. Charlie was talking about the Beatles in prison when he was talking to, like, with Creepy Krampus, guy.
Yeah, he's
like,
talking Alvin Krampus.
Yeah, Krampus.
Or not Krampus, Karpus, yeah.
And so he was referencing the Beatles, but we see in Manson in his own words, so he talks about, it's really interesting because he's just like, I didn't know anything. I didn't know goddamn one thing about the Beatles. I was in jail. Right.
Like, I respected them. I liked them because they were successful, and I liked the music a little bit.
But I was in jail from 1960 to 1967. I missed the Beatles.
Totally missed them. And the Beatles, you can't listen to the Beatles if you're in jail. You're going to get raped immediately.
And so he was like, yeah, no, I loved it when he was just like, my favorite music was the old guys who really could sing, like Paul Anka and
Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Perry Como. Yeah. Wow. He said that the people that were really into the White Album and deciphering the lyrics, that was Susan Atkins and this other guy, Little Paul. And Susan Atkins, of course, was one of the murderers.
And so now we're going to learn that Charles Manson, the ever-changing con man, knows that you're going to have to follow the group vibe. The whole vibe is now moving towards, like, they're all listening to the White Album, dropping acid, start having these, like, long, weird conversations, and he's got to jump into it head first and hang with them.
Yeah.
And we're going to see these philosophies come out of that time period.
And there's other people in the family starting to get really fucking dark. Tex Watson, he had a bit of a bad trip that really turned this guy on his head. He walked into the kitchen one day, and this guy named Indian Joe had gone out to the desert.
Which is weird, is it? Because he was Italian.
Yeah.
Well, Italians used to play Indians in movies all the time. So, it made
sense.
Still do. So he had gone out to the desert to get a plant to make a sort of like psychedelic tea with it.
This thing called belladonna.
Yes, belladonna root. And belladonna root. We all know what we're thinking about when we say belladonna. Yeah, we all gaping. Yes.
Yeah, you got to put it in your butt. You got to put the root in your butt. I guess.
Just like, stop licking the microphone.
I'm not
covers.
Licking the microphone. Oh, that is, I thought it was a breast. Yeah. That is the microphone. I apologize.
So belladonna root, the hallucinations are supposed to be terrible.
Yes.
Like they're supposed
to be
terrifying.
It's like angel trumpets, where it's photorealistic, insane hallucinations. And basically, you're not supposed to cook it inside. Indian Joe starts boiling this root in order to make the tea, and it's creating poison gas inside. Tex is a fucking moron.
Yeah.
He walks in.
Huffs it, yeah.
Yeah, he pulls it out of the thing and eats it. He's like, oh, what's this? And he eats it. He goes off on a trip for days.
He eats it like a baked potato. Like, you're only supposed to sip this tea. He brings this fucking belladonna root out, and he eats it, like they said, like a fucking potato. Like, just starts chomping into it.
So he ruined it for everybody.
Like, he ruined it for everyone and also lost his fucking mind.
And he was never the same.
Yeah, he went out to they found him in Van Nuys on his hands and knees, crawling through a crowd of children, saying, beep, beep, beep. Beep, beep, beep.
That's right. It's a funny thing. But when
you're
trying
a funny thing, because if you're a kid, then you're like, oh, look at the human train.
He's core. He's fun.
Yeah, that is fun.
But then he was never the same after that. So, so we're going to see, he's going to basically influence the other half of the group. While Charlie was out balling whatever new girl that he could find to bring into, just to make the group bigger.
Yeah.
Was Dennis Wilson still around, or he
Dennis Wilson had left.
Uh-huh. Yeah, by now he had left. But Manson, he thought that the Beatles, the Helter Skelter theory is really Vincent Bugliosi's theory.
Yeah.
So a lot of this stuff that we're going to be talking about, this is what Bugliosi says, but it's also kind of the stuff that, you know, Susan Atkins got on and the stuff that Manson just went ahead and followed.
And now, again, this is where the two stories diverge, where we're going to talk about his side, the Bugliosi side, which is the idea that Manson is a master
Kingpin,
manipulator and did it, and then I'm going to read the actual story. Speech that Manson supposedly gave from his book, Manson, his own words.
Yeah, so according to Manson's followers, he thought the Beatles were prophets that were tuned in, and he said that everything that in the double LP had meaning, even the cover of the White Album, that was the Beatles' way of showing their allegiance to the white race. And according to Charlie's interpretations of the album, a war between the blacks and the whites were imminent. A war would start when blacks would commit a series of brutal murders in posh white communities. And according to Charlie, the Beatles wanted him to release his own album, which would trigger the pending revolution and map out an escape route into the desert for the chosen few, and the family would move to California's Death Valley and hide underground until the race war was over.
And then because quote-unquote black people would not be able to govern themselves, the Manson family would rise
due to inexperience.
They would rise from the hole in the desert, and they would teach them how to revolve around their own government.
Yeah.
Now, this is what Bugliosi said?
Yeah, and that Charles Manson used this theory to make the kids murder.
Okay.
Now, how Manson kind of puts it down in his own words is that everyone was just basically ready to split. Everyone was ready to leave.
Yeah, they were
group.
In the middle of nowhere.
Because they were
Tex Watson still dumping in his own pants. And
you know, his
the
album
walls.
Isn't coming out. They want to move to a new spot. So he gave this speech about how he's basically started talking about how because they were all bitching about the desert, and he started screaming, "The desert's got everything. Hell, the whole desert ain't nothing but an upside down river. Water's running under every inch of it. How do you think those springs stay full? You just have to know where it's at. I came across places out there where the sun don't beat down on you all day, and it never gets cold in the winter, and water's everywhere. It's underground. I haven't explored it yet, but I sat on the edge of the hole and I watched the water flowing underneath. Man, the possibilities of that place are endless. And hell, we could find that hole again and build our own city in there. Why do you think we've been breaking our asses to put together all this equipment, the dune buggies, the generators, the supplies? All the gas we've been stashing out there to make going into that desert a paradise. Barker's and the Myers place ain't nothing compared to what we'll have going for us. When our records hit the market, we'll build our own town. In the meantime, if we put our act together, we can make the desert just as comfortable as we want it to be. Think about it. No rent to pay, no laws to obey, and no cops on our asses. Hey, we'll be one step ahead of anything that goes on in this world. Look around you. The worm's turning on the white man. Him and his pigs have put the dollar in front of everything. Even his own kids. Blackie's tired of being the doormat for the rich man's pad. So while the white man's locked into his dollars, Blackie's balling the blonde blue-eyed daughters and making mixed babies. It's all leading to bad shit. Real madness is gonna explode soon. Everything is gonna be helter-skelter. But that won't affect us, because we'll be in a beautiful land and only we know how to survive it. To be ready, we need equipment and supplies by the tons. If we have to do a little stealing and hustling to get what we need, let's do it.
Yeah.
Right. That's a great speech. Motivational.
He was very paranoid about the race war.
Well,
the black and white thing, that was something that he was paranoid, that he became more paranoid about later. But in the beginning,
this probably goes back to his prison life as well, right? I mean,
it had
segregated.
Something to do with it. And he does, you know, in full disclosure, and Manson in his own words, throws out the N-bomb a couple of
times. Quite a bit. And the whole thing, too. But basically, what he's saying is he gave an ignorant speech about what the desert was and what they could do for it. And they took all this.
Yeah.
And then they took all of it and they used it. And I'm certain that there's... I just can't help... I just don't think Manson's smart enough...
He's not.
...to have actually manipulated them. I think it literally just kind of came out of his mouth. And they're all like, yeah...
That's right.
Yeah, because he was just trying to buy time.
He's not forward-thinking enough.
No.
For anything.
Because his
any
whole philosophy,
because
he was talking about the whole time, his whole philosophy
today,
is that now is the moment. Forget about tomorrow. Now. And so all he wants to do is keep having sex with three girls at a time. That's all he cares about.
Yeah.
You know, he's an idiot and a maniac, but he doesn't care about the violence. He just wants to get his dick sucked.
Yeah. And Bugliosi, he said that Manson had told them a local Hopi Indian legend which there were three underground cities in California, one of which was in Death Valley, and the legend described a race of lizard people
exactly.
who 5,000 years ago built three underground cities, and Charlie supposedly told the family about an underground city of gold with a lake of life,
which he probably did.
Man, there's a city out there gold with a bunch
story.
Of lizard people, and there's an underground city full of gold with a lake of life.
Especially later on when you're trying to have to rebuild the story, and once you've blurted out the helter-skelter thing and how there's water underground, now you're taking ass. Said now everybody's hanging out.
Yeah.
He's desperate to keep the group together.
He should have told them how to spell it.
Yes.
He should have mentioned how to spell helter skelter. That would have helped.
Yep. And Charlie, he said the whole thing about the desert was that I love being out there, so did some of the kids. The hassles we were getting from the police, my rap about possible troubles with the races, and the picture of a better place to live put the kids into a game for anything frame of mind.
So the kids are still like 17, 18 years old now.
What's up?
They've only aged, what, a year?
A year.
Two years?
Yeah. I mean,
so
I would say the average age...
how long have they been in the desert for now?
I don't know, 3 months?
Yeah. 3 months, okay.
Because it kept bouncing back and forth from the desert to Los Angeles.
Yeah, right. From the desert. And they also had another house in Los Angeles that they call the Yellow Submarine. They were in three locations at this point. They were going between the Yellow Submarine, Spawn Ranch, and the Barker Ranch out in Death Valley.
Because technically, he was also still, like, there is another attempt of him recording an album in this time period, and he sucked at it. And he just couldn't do it.
Yeah, he just couldn't do it, yeah. So as far as the songs go, in the White Album, there were a few. So, I mean, you got to remember, okay, Helter Skelter, yeah, you listen to it, it's a real, like, it's a fucking scary song.
It's awesome.
It's a precursor to punk.
It's great.
It's a fucking amazing song. But this is also a song on the White Album.
Yeah.
This is another song on the White Album.
Yay! Takes me back to college, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, I did a lot of drugs for this album, and I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't just, I mean, Obla Di Obla Da is a very, you know, like, that's a very simple, easy song.
It's from Life Goes On.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And there's other songs on.
And so now he started building all of the songs on the White Album into his philosophy.
He starts building them all together. Damn. And there are other albums on there. Like this song is, I mean, this is truly one of my favorite songs ever. Happiness Is a Warm Gun, which this is a pretty dark song. And he said that Happiness Is a Warm Gun was warning the blacks to arm against the whites in the coming race war. But Happiness Is a Warm Gun is a fantastic song.
I think
song.
That's a good point, because if I know anything about black culture, they loved the Beatles. And they were all going out to get the newest Beatle LP as soon as it came out.
Yeah. And the one that they supposedly listened to the most was a song called Blackbird. And so Blackbird,
yeah,
they
now
said...
This song, man, you, like, can see, man, every time I get fucking pumped,
like,
up. When
I fucking, when I listen to Blackbird,
it's some,
like,
mayhem.
Fuck, man, like, I want to fucking take the system down, so let's fucking listen to...
Yeah,
fucking,
I
want to
get fucking,
man,
pumped,
let's
pumped
fucking
up,
listen
dude.
To,
I'm going to take off my shirt.
Yeah, I'll leave your shirt on.
Yeah, let's fucking take a listen to Blackbird.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
Fuck yeah! Let's kill some fucking people.
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah, man.
If you play it really loud, it sounds aggressive.
I'm gonna stab a pregnant woman in the belly tonight.
Cut out the child, yeah.
Yeah, that's very Blackbird. Cool. And Charlie believed that Blackbird was the Beatles telling black people that it was their turn to rise up into power.
Cool,
and
yeah.
That they were being programmed to start the revolution.
Definitely.
It's possible.
Yeah. Absolutely, it is. Yeah. It definitely is.
Yeah, and another fucking song, another, a song right. called fucking Piggies. It was saying that there was a line of, like, what they need's a damn good whacking.
Yeah, get the pigs. Yeah.
What
man.
They need's a damn good whacking. It's the next track on the album. Here's fucking Piggies.
Is this NWA?
I'm not as pumped up by this song.
I like this one because it makes me think of warm pigs in a blanket.
Is it sad that
I
close my eyes and I see myself, like, opening my mouth and tiny little pigs walking into my mouth?
Yeah. And, of course, Piggies. You know, and Sexy Sadie.
Sadie.
Well, they saw that as a sign that they were in
talking
because,
to them.
Because he had named Susan Atkins Sadie earlier that year.
Right.
So he thought, okay, this is something, like, this is how they're in tune with my fucking mind.
Yeah, synchronicities.
And Honey Pie, like, was another thing. Honey Pie was my favorite. They said that Honey Pie meant the line, Honey Pie, you're making me crazy, I'm in love, but I'm lazy, so won't you please come home? That meant that the Beatles were too lazy to go look for Jesus and wanted Charlie to come find
and
them.
I wish he had showed up at the Abbey Road.
Yeah.
He's been like, hey, guys, you've been calling for me, huh? Yeah. Hey, so you guys got any, like, free food or something? Hey, Paul, you got any maybe shoes or something? The way I lost my shoes.
Yeah, they would have let him right in. They would have loved him.
So,
Charlie, come on in. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. For the Beatles. Oh, yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah, that's a good accent.
Yeah, that's Liverpool.
Liverpudlian. Liverpudlian, yeah.
They call them.
Oh, Charlie, I hope you want to suck my dick.
No, he probably would. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Charlie.
Seems like all you got to do to get Charlie Manson to suck your dick is to ask nicely.
Ask him.
He definitely seems surprised by the money.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Just got
absolutely, because he's just like, I don't know who'd pay for this. That's I'm not necessarily a professional.
No,
so in early 1969, the family's getting bigger, and they need, and they're also moving out to the desert. The only problem with living out in the desert is that you're a long way from supplies, so you have to buy supplies in a larger quantity.
And so he becomes obsessed with making dune buggies, and they steal credit cards.
Going
he's
to
obsessed
Costco.
With these dune buggies.
Yeah, dune buggies. It is his biggest obsession is dune buggies.
Dune buggies are very fun to
play
with.
They steal VW bugs and they convert them into dune buggies because it's all a part of his desert plans. If we're going to live in the desert, we're going to need some way to get around. And also, dune buggies are awesome.
Dune buggies. But so at this time, he's waiting for this money that's supposed to show up for his album. It doesn't show up. They have no money. They're running out of time. Basically, he's trying to figure out what to do. So he's, in his mind, Manson's like, I'm going to have to go back to my old tricks. I'm going to have to break my vow. I need to get back into crime.
Yeah. And so he starts hanging out with biker groups, including the Easy Riders and Satan Slaves.
Yeah.
The funny thing about Satan Slaves is when the Manson family was first caught, the press named them Satan Slaves because the biker gang was involved.
Like, hey,
Yeah.
Technically, Satan Slaves is copyrighted. You can talk to our lawyer. This is Irv Schleichman, and he is our lawyer. Technically, the Satan Slaves is copyrighted. So we will sue for defamation of character.
Yeah.
My buddy here, Chains, has got to rape a woman at one. So if we can get over this this meeting really quick, that'd be great.
So Terry Melcher, he comes back out one last time.
He
to
films
take a
them.
Listen. He films them, yeah.
And then his result was, he said that it was mediocre.
Yeah.
I'm sure that it was, yeah.
Yes, mediocre. So in June of 1969, Tex Watson, he fucks over a black 300-pound drug dealer named Bernard Lotsa Papa Crow.
Which was a mistake. He literally went and just showed...
Yeah, Lotsa Papa Crow.
The way it goes down is that, like, Tex goes, steals weed. It's like weed and money from this guy,
so
right?
Like, good idea. It's like $2,000.
Yeah, and so he leaves. Charlie gets a call just being like, is this Tex? I have this chick.
No, he said, is Charlie there?
Yeah, because his name is Charlie.
Like, the girl, because Tex Watson was living with the woman in L.A., and she told him, and he's like, and Crow shows up and says, where's my fucking money? Where's my fucking drugs? And she says, okay, let me call Charlie. Charlie will fix it. But remember, Tex Watson's first name is also Charlie. So she calls out to the ranch and she says, Charlie, you got to come help me. Except it's Charles Manson on the phone. He's like, whoa, 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 whoa. What the fuck is going on here? The guy, Crow, the drug dealer, gets on the phone and says, you get here, you get me my money right now, or I'm going to fucking kill this bitch. And so Charles says, okay.
He goes, all right. He goes to like,
one thing we know about lots of Papa Crow, he ain't messing around.
And he goes, and then Charlie literally goes to all the bikers hanging around and being like, so, like, any of y'all want to, like, come with me? Maybe help me? And they're all like, actually, I gotta shine my bike a little bit.
It's amazing how busy people can get when Lotsa Papa Crow wants to murder you.
Yeah. And so he brings along a member of the family, just kind of a weak little kid, and they bring a gun along. And it's the DA says that Tex was under Charlie's direction to steal money from this drug dealer to start the race war.
Right.
But really, Manson's explanation sounds a lot more plausible.
Pretty plausible. Where he basically just showed up. The whole scenario heightened. He showed him the gun. He was just like, you know, he basically tried to trade his life. According to Manson, he tried to trade his life for the girl's life. He was like, I was trying to buy time, trying to buy time. Let me go and get some money. I'll get you some money. I'll get it tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. Lots of Papa's like, no fucking way. I want my money now. He's like, I'll give you 4 hours. He's like, no, fuck you. I'm going to give you 2 hours. And then finally, Charles Manson turns the gun on him. Lots of Papa's like, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to fucking kill me? He pulls the trigger, click. Lots of Papa grabs the gun, starts choking Charlie out, pushing him against the wall. Meanwhile, Charlie's still got the gun in his hands, sticking in his belly, going click, click, click. And then finally, I guess there was 2 bullets in it. Bam! Shoots in the stomach, and they fucking get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
Except he says he grabs one of his buddy's shirts. One of the enforcer's shirts. He's like, I liked his doe-skin shirt, and he was so scared of me that I asked him for it.
That's great. Charles is the man. Yeah.
And he said that he felt no remorse whatsoever for it.
No, he was going to get killed.
Yeah,
He but said then, it was in self-defense. But what happened was later that night, and Charlie believed that he had killed the guy. He didn't know, because lots of Bob, but he didn't die. He just bled for a while, got himself fixed up by some sort of criminal doctor, and never reported it to the police. But later on that night.
HMO.
Yeah.
Jeez, you know.
I know what that's all about.
So, talking about health care.
don't get us started on hearing last podcast on the left talking about universal health care.
Well, we're going to talk some truth to power next week.
Mm-hmm.
So later that night, Charlie's watching TV with one of his buddies, and he sees a news report that says that a high-ranking member of the Black Panthers had been murdered.
He's so
his
retarded.
Body
he
dumped just, on the hospital's front lawn. So yeah, he just immediately thinks like, oh my God, I killed a black person!
Which is just like, that's such a high thought. That's such like a stone, like, you know what I mean? Like, and I shot a black guy tonight, and that black guy, he had to have been in the Panthers. Oh, this is me. This is me. It's me. I killed somebody.
Yeah. And so his paranoia kicks into high fucking gear because he now believes that the Black Panthers are going to come down on the Manson family.
So he starts now, like during this time period, he starts talking about this race war more and more and more.
Yeah, he said the kids at the ranch caught the worst of my paranoia. So this shit about the race war is just seeping in all these fucking, and specifically seeping in to Tex Watson's brain. Because Tex Watson, he is essentially responsible for the start of this whole
Tex
thing.
Tex is a moron.
And Charlie's just fucking putting it into his head like, this is your fault, Tex. This whole thing is your fault. You started this. You're bringing the Black Panthers down this. And you need to fucking fix
it. Figure it out. And so, and then also they're looking for money from Terry Melcher at this point. Things are really tough. And I like this breakdown that he has of Charlie. Yeah. Where Terry Melcher, which is such a producer like line, where he goes and asks for the money that he owes him for the recording, and he's like, Charlie, there's mixed emotions about promoting you. You're unpredictable. You amaze me at times, and other times disappoint the hell out of me. Jacobson told me this morning you were involved with shooting some Negro, so frankly, for the time being, we're skeptical about investing any time or money in you.
Right.
Yeah.
That's about as nice as you can possibly say. You're a lunatic. Please leave now.
You killed somebody. Get the fuck out of my office, please.
Please. Why
and
here?
He had gone to the Beach Boys accountant, and he had fucked with them too. His mouth got the better of him. He said, you know what, man? You owe me the money, and it's a long overdue bill. Just pay up, or I'm going to do something to make you regret it. Like one of these nights, you might go home and see nothing but charred embers where your house was.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Charles Manson is now, he's upping his game.
He's off the rails.
He's off the rails, and the problem here too is that every single time he expands his like image to somebody and tells somebody he's going to hurt him, they're expecting results.
Yeah.
Now like they're expecting him to fulfill the other end and fulfill his threats.
Yeah. Exactly. And so this is finally after Terry Melcher says, no, nuh-uh, this isn't going to happen. That combined with the paranoia of the Black Panther, like Charlie, he's done with the world.
Yes.
The world is over. And he's just going on rants all the time about the world is not for them. They will never accept them.
Kind of like Jim Jones. Same thing, where it's just like once the heat starts coming down, he starts putting it into so he can spread the blame.
Yeah. So he can spread the blame around. And so, of course, they're still dealing drugs at this time. And one of their biggest connections was a man named Gary Hinman. And Gary Hinman is described as being pretty much the consummate nice guy drug dealer.
Yes, he was like a Owley, the guy that invented LSD.
Yeah.
He was just a scientist that was a friend of hippies that had made a bunch of drugs that would kind of give him out. He was a true hippie.
Yeah.
He was like Stephen Wright's character in Half-Baked. Just kind of hanged out on the couch and everyone loved him because he always had drugs.
And he let the Manson family stay over at his house all the time. A very welcoming guy. But he made mescaline and he had made a big batch for some bikers in which the Manson family was the connect. Unfortunately, the batch was bad, made a lot of bikers and their customers deathly ill, so of course the bikers wanted their money back.
Hinman's like, no way. Well,
there's no returns. Like, this isn't Kmart.
No, exactly.
You know, you didn't buy a lawnmower that didn't work.
Hinman even said to them, just being like, hey, if you can give me the drugs, I'll check them out and I can fix them up. And they're like, well, no, the bikers toss the drugs. And he's like, that I'm not giving you any fucking
fuck
money.
Off.
Yeah,
you
it's 2 grand.
All the drugs. Yeah,
it's 2 grand. That's a lot of fucking money. I mean, it's like 10 grand.
Sure,
it's a lot. And so Charlie's on the phone with Hinman,
and he's
fighting. Like,
yeah.
I mean, he's just fucking screaming and yelling. And Susan Atkins is sitting right next to him, and Charlie slams the phone down, and he just kind of mutters like, "Oh, to kill the motherfucker."
And then, in Charles Manson's words, he turns to Sadie and jokingly says,
"Winks at her."
Yeah, go kill him for me, Sadie. Which is the thing that that Bugliosi uses against him forever as a direct command. He says he did it as a joke. I think it was somewhere between the two.
Yeah. I think it was somewhere between, it's like, go kill him, Sadie. It's like, and I thought, you know, man, if she does, I ain't going to mind all that much.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, that's kind of what, not a direct quote, but if you want to, go ahead.
So basically, they go intimidate, it's Bobby Boussillier and Susan Atkins and Mary Bruner go to go intimidate Hinman. They would look for money. He's not giving them anything. So, Trio, they call Charlie.
Yeah.
I love this whole thing.
Yeah.
Manson, knowing Hinman was like a freak behind some kind of Japanese Buddhism, he grabbed a sword given to him by a biker to intimidate his ass with a display of oriental swordsmanship.
Direct quote.
Yeah.
Just oriental swordsmanship. He went over to Hinman's place, but in reality, the quote-unquote sword was just a 2-foot blade taped to a piece of wood.
Yeah,
and he was whipping it around.
And he called it his magic blade, but it was something that a biker made when he was fucked up.
I bet you he looked exactly like that Star Wars kid, the first kid to go viral, filmed himself all fat, flipping around.
You cannot see the blade because it is moving too fast.
So, in an attempt to try to intimidate Bobby, or to intimidate him into giving him their money, Charlie cut off Hinman's ear.
Which is just also a pussy thing, too, because he kind of just, like, did it. He kind of went like, hey!
And Bruner, I mean, to her credit, she did sew his ear back on with dental floss.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that's not bad.
It has a nice minty flavor and smell to it.
So Charlie leaves, and he leaves Bobby, Mary, and Susan alone with Hinman. And the next morning, the trio, they drive up in Hinman's VW bus.
And he's like, where's Hinman?
Yeah, he's like, where's him? And, like, why do you have his bus? And Bobby just said, well, like, he started screaming, and we didn't want the cops to come in, so we killed him.
Meanwhile, what's her sputs? Then they wrote political piggy on the wall in his blood to start to, as a thing to Charlie, being like, listen, no, but now what we've done here is that we're going to start the race war. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
We're doing what you wanted us to do, Charlie.
He wrote political piggy on the wall and then put a bloody paw print.
And then Charlie went like,
to make it look like the Black Panthers did it.
Yeah, then Charlie went like, gulp. Ooh.
Yeah, he said his first thought after they told him was, that's two now.
Yeah.
And before they were done, 8 more people would be dead.
It's really
we'll
interesting.
Talk about that.
Yeah, and next week we're going to go into the really violent murders, and then we're going to see Charlie at his best live from prison.
sort of like Johnny Cash live from Folsom Prison, but then Johnny got to leave.
Yes.
And Charles never did.
Yes. I do. I love this story. Charles Manson is it's very interesting when you watch it because it's not like any other story that we've ever covered here. He really is a story of a lifelong criminal.
Yeah.
That he set up all the pieces and then it played itself out all in just the worst ways possible.
A bad general with a real dumb army.
And I do want to say that, like, I remember, like, because I know this group thing too, where there was a period of time when Eddie and I were living together. We had a bunch of crust punks living with us. And they would come and they would pull the mirrors off the walls and they were doing like lines of Adderall all night. And Eddie told me the story. Well, one night we had a very sweet roommate. He was just kind of like a good, sweet, endearing punk with his friend who was like crazy. And they were up all night doing Adderall and Eddie was up. And so they're in there in the other room and they're like, ride or die, man. Ride or die. Tonight, man. We're going to get a gun. I'm gonna go fucking kill somebody, man.
Cool.
And they're like, let's go fucking kill somebody. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, we're gonna shoot a fucking cop, man. And it's just like, yeah, dude, yeah, yeah. He's like, the first thing we're gonna do is we're gonna get the gun. We're gonna go in the other room. We're gonna kill your fucking roommates. And then we're gonna go down the street and we're gonna shoot a cop in the head. And then our buddy was just like, hey, man, let's not kill my roommates. They're like, cool. They're good.
He
was just like, you know what? It's true. Your roommates are like cool and funny. We won't kill your roommates. And Eddie was just like in the other room, like listeners going like, don't kill the roommates.
Oh, man.
I mentioned it earlier. You could, I think, the nearest analog that you could come to the Manson family today is gutter punks, crust punks.
Yep.
Like, that's what these people were. They were fucking crust punks.
Right.
Well, that's
right,
it. So phase two. I hope everyone had a happy Halloween. I had a wonderful Halloween.
So did I. I had such a great Halloween.
So good.
One of the best Halloweens I've ever had, I'd say. Like this year, all of the good Halloween feelings that people sent our way, it fucking worked.
Really worked. So hail Satan, everybody.
Hail yourselves, and let's see, any major announcements here? Do we have anything to say?
Yes, we said some at the top of the episode, but it will help us out so much to keep this show free and to make us just a little bit of money if you go to podsurvey.com/last and take a survey so we can get ourselves some advertisers.
And that would be incredible because it costs no money. We won't be asking you for money.
We will never ask you for money. We will never require you to give money to pay for this show.
All you gotta do is fill out this survey.
It will always be free. It's short. It's anonymous. And you have a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card.
That's great.
Yeah, that's podsurvey.com/last. It's going to help us out so fucking much. You know, it's like we give you a lot of stuff for free. Small thing to just help us get a couple of advertisers.
Do it for Satan. And you can even put Hail Satan in the comments and they'll see that it's
Yeah, you can put Hail Satan in the comments. You can do whatever you want. But yeah, be sure to go to podsurvey.com/last. And if you want a Last Podcast t-shirt, cavecomedyradio.com/lastpodcast on the left.
And follow
you can
us
get
on
one
Twitter.
There. Yeah.
That's Henry Loves You on Twitter, Marcus Parks, and I'm Ben Kissel. And I'll do a Hail Yourselves.
Hail me!
Halkeen.
Me gusta leche.
Oh, me gusta leche.
Me gusta leche.
Me gusta leche.
Cheer up, Charlie. You want to go out on a song?
Yeah, let's go out on a song like this. Let's go out on something that, let's get some of the sensitive side of Charlie. There's a song called People Say I'm No Good.
People say I'm no good.
God, my panties are sopping.
It's great.
But they never, never do they say why their world is so mixed up or how it got that way.
I'm having one.